Thousands of new books for children and young adults are published each year, but only a few become bestsellers, and we wondered why that is. Almost all of them seem pretty attractive to me. Here to discuss the creation of best-selling books for kids are Jean Fywell, Senior Vice President and Publisher of Fywell and Friends and Square Fish, Micah Hirschman, Manager in the Children's Department at Borders Group Incorporated, and Diane Roback, Senior Children's Editor of Publishers Weekly, and I'm very pleased to welcome them all to the show. Hello.
Hello.
Jean, while you were at Scholastic, you published some of the best-selling children's book series of all time, the Babysitter's Club, Goosebumps, and the first six books of the Harry Potter series. How far into the process did you need to go before you knew that you had something big on your hands?
You know, I think that it is an evolving process. I don't think you know necessarily from the very beginning, although there's something about the reading that excites you and engages you immediately. But, you know, in order for something big to happen, I think so many things have to fall into place, and part of it is a little bit magic.
And I assume that there were some really big surprise hits and others where you were totally dead wrong.
You mean I've made some mistakes?
Well, you've said, I think this is going to really be big, and then it bombed.
Yes.
Or I don't really see this thing doing well, and it became
a
monster.
And it did enormously well, absolutely.
So nobody really knows.
I don't think anybody really knows. I think the confluence of events that have to do with timing, that have to do at the core, which is a very good story and a great author, the packaging, the title, the marketing, all of those things have to conspire to make something very successful.
Well, what about the marketing? Are you marketing to kids or to the adults who buy for the kids?
I think all of the above. I think when you're publishing for children, there are gatekeepers involved in children's books, so whether those are booksellers or librarians or teachers or parents. But, you know, certainly from my point of view, I'm a child-centric publisher, so I always am aiming for the child.
Micah, do you ever have to make suggestions to publishers about a particular book's content or format before committing to buying enough to stock in all your stores?
As Jean mentioned, there are lots of gatekeepers in the industry. We're all advocates for children and reading. So by the time books make it to us, we're really trying to help tweak. We're really trying to use some of the sales history, the knowledge about what's worked in the recent past and the kind of future trends to pick what one or two books out of their great list we're really going to stand behind and make sure everybody knows about.
But you wouldn't say, we love this book, but you have to change this?
Very rarely ever. We get picky about covers, but that's usually subjective.
Well, what factors do you consider when you're deciding which books Borders will stock?
It's a great question, and there's a number of factors. Stocking versus kind of what makes a bestseller is a good initial distinction to make.
Well, you have to decide how many you're going to buy, which is you're assuming this book is really going to do well and you want to have a lot in each store, or maybe you just want to have one or two.
Sure. We use a number of factors. Largely, I rely on every day the expertise of my team. So the buyers we have are, you know, world-class experts at picking these things out. They know every book in their backlist assortment. They know what's worked and what will work. We do leverage technology and a wealth of sales data across publishers and formats to really, you know, understand what kind of books work and don't. We really also truly believe in understanding what our customers are looking for, what they've wanted in the past, and trying to help them find things that we think they are not aware of, but they might like.
Well, you're a national chain.
Absolutely.
So that I would assume that your customers in one part of the country might want something very different than in other parts of the country.
That's very, very true, and we are proud of the fact that we tailor our assortment regionally. However, we do look for those trends that bubble up beyond regional bestsellers or, you know, mid-list success into what are really our customers and what are kids looking for, you know, nationally.
Diane, how has the children's book industry changed in the past 20 years?
Well, I'd say one of the biggest factors has been the explosive growth in the retailing sector, where I'd say about 20 years ago, primarily children's books were bought by schools and libraries, and that has completely changed. That landscape has completely changed in the last 20 years. And I'd say back in the mid-80s, you had an explosive growth in the children's-only booksellers, and which was a huge rise across country, which created a market for children's books in the retail market that hadn't existed before. And that was hand in hand with some of the bigger bestsellers we saw in the 80s, several of which Gene published, the Goosebumps series and the Babysitter's Club series. And I would contend you couldn't have done that without the booksellers helping out or there being that kind of market for them.
Well, when parents first start buying books for their kids, I think they usually buy the books that they loved when they were kids.
That's true.
Then they have to get past that.
That's true.
That's where the boom really occurs, when you get past Goodnight Moon.
It's true, and that is where an independent bookseller, nothing against the chains because they move an awful lot of books too, but an independent bookseller, they've been instrumental in putting books in the hands of parents who would walk in and say, "I remember Madeline. I remember Curious George. That's what I'll get." I mean, every new warden gets a copy of Goodnight Moon, but there's books beyond that. And I think the industry at large, there's an awful lot more choice available these days.
My guests are Diane Roback, senior children's editor at Publishers Weekly; Jean Fywell, who's a senior vice president and publisher of Fywell and Friends, and also Squarefish; and Micah Hirschman, manager in the children's department of Borders Group Incorporated. We will continue our conversation. We're not taking a break. Oh, I'm so happy. We could just keep on going here. Well, so when we got past the classics, I'm sure still, Gene, the fantasy is to come up with a Goodnight Moon, because that goes on forever. That's going to sell year in, year out. But we're seeing more and more books that have a kind of a topical side to them, aren't we?
I think there's a currency to books that are published. If you mean a topical side, meaning that they address the child who is, you know, the sort of hurry child, the contemporary, the Gossip Girl, the mm-hmm. series, yes, because I think that there's a certain success to those series and those books and always have been, but though they're not necessarily enduring, you don't necessarily have huge commercial success and then have that last.
So, Micah, how does that affect you? A Gossip Girl series, which is very much of the moment with the latest technology, you're going to buy it for a first printing but not assume that you're going to restock it 3 or 4 times?
Not at all. We assume that book selling is a democracy, and if Gossip Girl sells enormously well and people come back for it in year 2 and year 3, then we'll be buying it in year 2 and year 3. And if sales on a classic slow down, then the people are not interested necessarily in those books. So our goal, every single one of our team members' goal, is to make sure that we are watching this and that we're really servicing what our customers are looking for.
Do you have any worries that some of these books will become dated quickly?
No. We're thrilled with every copy of a book we put into a kid's hands because it's furthering reading. And if they read Gossip Girl, then maybe they'll go on to read Jane Austen.
Mm. Well, who was the greatest Gossip Girl of all time? What's the minimum number of books Borders will purchase of a specific title?
One.
Really? You do one and you just stick it in one of your stores?
Absolutely. If that's the right place to have that book and the customer is looking for it in that location, we'll buy one.
Well, location, I throw this out to all of you, location on another level has to be a key factor. How important is placement in the success of a book? How important is it to be up on the front table rather than back in the shelves?
Well, I think you want representation. You want the account, whoever it is, to take the book. And then merchandising that book is critical. So if it's front of the store, that, of course, is something you pay for. You know, you sort of pay as you go. Or front of the children's section or special display in the children's section. So I think that, you know, there's so much out there, there's so much noise and static that any kind of special display you can get is going to be meaningful.
So a bigger publisher, a publisher that can afford to pay for upfront placement, is more likely to have a success with a book than somebody who has that same book but can't afford to put it in the front of the store.
Yeah. I mean, that being understood that the account has to want it. So the publisher may want to pay for it, but even so, and Micah will say this, you know, they may not necessarily want it.
Yeah, and vice versa. I'd also suggest there are many times when publishers are smaller and they don't have funds at all, and we want that book in the front of the store, and we'll do what it takes to make sure our customers know that those are the books we're advocating for.
Well, how important is merchandising for a kid's book? Because they're usually more visual, you got to be able to see them, don't you?
I would suggest that it is important. We do understand that publishing churns out a lot of books, and that customers, as parents, especially in the children's section, are harried, and perhaps they don't read PW Daily every day and understand what's the biggest buzz book. So what we really feel strongly about is making sure that we're advocates for them, that our buyers have reviewed those assortments and they've put them on an end cap or a table or somewhere really visible so that the parents will understand this is something we believe in.
I'm glad you mentioned the word harried, because I assume that the Harry Potter books don't have to be given any prominence. They're going to sell if you hide them in the basement.
That's true at one level and untrue at another. They will sell. They will not sell as well. Obviously, you know, put it front and center in front of people and you're going to sell another copy.
But it also brings up an interesting point, is that when Harry Potter first came out, it was not the phenomenon that it became, and it was not merchandised in front of store, and it was a word-of-mouth kind of a book.
Because Scholastic's also didn't have the kind of money that it later got as a result of the success of
I think Scholastic was already merchandising some of its other books pretty heavily. It wasn't like this started any kind of huge trend. It was just this was a fantasy book that the company had a fair amount of hope for, but it wasn't like they did not push it in the same way that...
No, I mean, I think the expectation was the initial first printing on Harry Potter was 30,000 copies.
That's because everybody had turned it down.
It had
they?
Been... I mean, Scholastic had won the day at an auction, but basically thought, you know, this was a fantasy by a British writer unknown in this country, and, you know, they were going to do the best they could, and really had a kind of cautious approach, brought over Jo Rowling and had her meet booksellers. And it was the beginning of a plan, but it was at least 3 or 4 months before anything significant happened to Harry Potter.
So it was 30,000 in the first printing. What was the last book's printing, initial
I think
printing?
It was over 11 million.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but there is the peer pressure factor in all of these things, isn't there? I mean, even perhaps more than in adult bestsellers, there is the kid tells the next kid that they love the book, and I've heard kids try to explain why they weren't reading Harry Potter because everybody else was.
There were a few hits like that. I mean, there's an example right now of these best-selling book called Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which has sold something like 800,000, 900,000 copies. And it's got some comics. It's got a kind of a graphic novel form. It's mostly a novel, but it's got a very compelling premise. I mean, any boy who sees Diary of a Wimpy Kid on the cover wants that. And I had one bookseller telling me that without fail, any kid who sees it brings it over to a parent and says, I want that book. Doesn't even open it and says, I want that book. And that book was not published as a bestseller. I think it speaks to the fact that you can't publish a bestseller. You publish a book and you hope it takes off, but there's many, many, many hopes dashed by publishing into being a bestseller.
But I mean, that would also suggest that it's on the cutting edge of a new trend. Graphic novels have been doing very well with adults in recent years, and it's the same thing is happening with kids.
Yeah, I think a more visual presentation of content. Also, I mean, I would bet you that if somebody brought that title, Diary of a Wimpy Kid, to a meeting, there would be someone in the room who said, well, you don't want to call a kid wimpy. You don't want to. That's not going to sell.
You're going to hurt someone's feelings.
Or, you know, yeah. And that's where sort of true genius really does shine through, where this guy has a very good sense of what a child will read.
Micah, how quickly do the books have to sell? At what point do you stop stocking a book, even though you thought when you first looked at it that it would do well?
That's a really hard question, and it depends on the category at the highest level. So adult or children's, fiction or nonfiction. It depends on the category. Deeper category levels depends on the format, hardcover versus a paperback. We have different expectations. And it depends on what you'd hope for going in. So if you had hoped, you bought 10,000 and you'd hoped to sell 8,000 and you really sell 7,000, well, it's still a modest success, but relative to your expectations, perhaps a disappointment.
Mm-hmm. Do adult books run into a similar timeline?
Yeah, absolutely. No question.
I mean, I think that if, as a rule, as a publisher, you learn how to manage your expectations, you're going to be a whole lot better off. If you want everything and hope and need everything to be a bestseller, you're going to be mighty disappointed.
My guests are Gene Fywell, Senior Vice President and Publisher of Fywell and Friends and Square Fish, Micah Hirschman, a manager in the Children's Department of Borders Group Incorporated, and Diane Roback, Senior Children's Editor of Publishers Weekly. Let's get back to the thing you can't avoid, which is Harry Potter. Why do you think it did take off the way that it did? Was it the marketing? Was it mostly word of mouth?
You know, I think that the book is genius. I think that the series is genius.
But there are other brilliant books out there, aren't
well,
there?
I think the timing of that was particular in that there was a lot of, you know, especially in the on the adult side, not a lot of originality or innovation in the publishing. You know, publishers had their authors on this production cycle writing a book a year, and I think there was something absolutely fresh about Harry Potter and emotionally alive. I mean, Harry is not just a fantasy. He's a character that has a lot of kids relating to him. So I just think I think the story was unusual. I think fantasy was about to happen, and really there wasn't a whole lot of it out there for children or for, you know, for anybody, but certainly for children it was a very it was not a vibrant category.
But I assume that it really has had an effect on all of kids' book publishing.
Absolutely.
Because it's gotten kids reading in a way that we were afraid they wouldn't read for a long time.
That's absolutely true on so many levels. First of all, just boys getting excited about books thrilled everyone in the publishing industry.
The
peer pressure became, have you read Harry Potter, as opposed to, what are you doing holding that book? You're not cool. It was cool to be reading. It was also cool to be reading a thick book. As the books progressed, they got thicker and thicker. That it was cool. Fantasy was, you couldn't give that stuff away in a bookstore before. And all of a sudden, kids are walking in the bookstores and the libraries saying, what else do you have? I love Harry Potter, but there's not another one coming for a year. Give me some more. And it woke up the industry in so many different directions.
Well, Diane, before the New York Times did it, you were the first to develop a children's bestseller list. Why is it important to calculate kids' book sales in a different category than adults?
Well, we got a lot of call for that. We started a bestseller list at Publishers Weekly back in 1988, and we had a lot of call for just that was really at the time I was talking about before, about bookstores really selling a large number of children's books. And the magazine that I work for has been calculating bestseller lists for decades, so it was a natural extension to start a children's list. The Times didn't start one until Harry Potter, and midway through Harry Potter, I think, when there was a feeling that he was knocking off many, many bestsellers, because in the publishing industry, you make more money. There's clauses written into contracts that if you get on the Times bestseller list and if you stay on it for a certain number of weeks, there's bonuses in your contract. So there were major, major adult authors who were now being knocked off the list thanks to Harry.
And were furious.
Well, how much money do the kids' bestsellers produce? I'm not talking about Harry Potter, which was published like an adult book. But I would assume that in the other books, the large format picture books, there's less profit because they have lower price points and usually have to have full color reproductions on every page.
Well,
is that Jane?
I think the cost of producing a picture book is obviously higher per unit. But you try to keep the price low because I think there is price resistance over a certain point, over $16.95. And your job is to try to sell more copies. But I think you can make a bestseller out of a picture book.
Mm-hmm. I get the message from you that a good book will find its way no matter what. Do you really believe that?
I've seen it happen time and time again. There certainly have been many.
I mean,
books
isn't creating buzz and all the other stuff.
No, I think kids, by and large, are immune to that kind of hype. I remember when Harry Potter came out, and I was doing more interviews about Harry, and they were saying, "Oh, isn't it just the hype for the kid?" But kids don't care about hype. You know, kids aren't being marketed to. Yes, they are. I shouldn't say that, but as far as those books went, that was really word of mouth and how it grew. So I don't know about the marketing to kids in that respect.
Well, you said in the old days, the important buyers were schools and libraries.
That's
and
right.
What proportion do they make up of sales today as opposed to chains like Borders?
Well, it can depend on the book, really, because traditionally the split was 80% the institutional market, schools and libraries, and 20% for bookstores. And, you know, what I've heard anecdotally is it's more half and half, but for more commercial books, it can be 30 or 40% schools and libraries with
right.
the bulk of it going to.
Well, Micah, in that case, they had to appeal to a librarian But in the case of the books that we're talking about, the books that you sell, I'm not sure who the appeal is really for, the kids or for the parents who are buying the book for the kids.
I think the appeal crosses all of those categories. We recognize that the mom is probably the primary purchase driver. We sponsor 2 events a year for educators. And we know that, you know, the kids are going to be the ones begging for the book. So we really try to address it at all levels. Ultimately, from my team's end, it's about the reader. So the I think I'd like to disagree a little bit and say that I think we see a ton of books that are fabulous, that are great books, whether they're brand new or older, that fade away and that never, you know, grew to be as huge and famous as we'd all love them to be. Part of that's due to packaging, part of that's due to marketing, and part of that's due to, you know, the fickleness and the way kids grow up so fast. But, yeah, we're absolutely out there trying to talk to all those people because we know they're all buying books.
Well, we also sometimes have parents liking books that the kids don't appreciate as much.
Sure.
And it's even been noted that the winners of the Newbery Prize are not often the books that the kids actually want to read, but everybody, all adults, think that they should want to read.
Sometimes that's a happy confluence of a book like Lewis Sacker's Holes was a perfect example of the gatekeepers loved it and the kids loved it and everyone loved it, but some years not so much.
Now, there a lot of kids' books are also reviewed. Does that matter, Micah? Do you see a bump when the New York Times gives a book a nice review?
We do sometimes. We generally have the understanding that those reviews are critical to the library market. They make a difference for us. Entertainment Weekly sometimes, but you'll never know what review will be meaningful. It doesn't really matter the source, whether, you know, it could be Oprah or Al Roker. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Gene, what accounts for the popularity of series books? I know with adults sometimes there's an automatic, anytime a Stephen King book comes out, it's almost guaranteed that it's going to sell a certain number of copies.
I think the appeal of series has always been, for kids anyway, is that you're hitting on something that they are relating to, whether it's that it's a scary book or it's a mystery or it's a friendship story. And then there's something in the formula that the reader who is not that capable, they are comfortable with the formula. They like the characters. They want to find out the next thing that's going to happen to those characters, or they want to read another story in that context, and they don't have to work so hard to find out about it.
And does that just stick with one generation of kids and then the next wants a different series?
Well, I've seen both, really, but by and large, a series has a natural arc. It has an ebb and it has a flow. And, I mean, a book like a series like Goosebumps, for instance, was white hot for a long period of time, and then the sales dropped and other things come up. So right now we have the Lightning Thief books by Rick Riordan, which are just enormous. There's a new book coming out in May. And really, I haven't seen the anticipation for a book since Harry Potter for this new title. So it keeps happening, and with, you know, successive series, I think.
Thank you so much, all of you, for talking with us today. Diane Roback is Senior Children's Editor at Publishers Weekly. Gene Fywell is Senior Vice President and Publisher of Fywell & Friends and Square Fish, formerly with Scholastic. And Micah Hirschman is a manager in the Senior Children's, is the Department of Borders Books. I got myself confused there. I think that I learned a lot about why I'm buying one book and not another book for the kid.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Martin Fletcher, currently the NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv, looks back at his 30 years as a war correspondent in some of the world's most volatile spots. Then Jimmy Breslin on the lore he's uncovered about the American Mafia. The third installment of our Political Projections film series explores how Hollywood has dealt with the cynical side of Washington politics. And Mark Harris on the 5 movies that were all nominated for Best Picture in 1968 and how they exemplify the ways Hollywood was changing. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Dina Mann, and Stephanie Hughes. Jake Cowart was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.